on again, off again, on again. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's canceled summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un may yet happen, but as U.S. and North Korean officials try to reach an agreement, it's not just the Americans who are seeking guarantees.
According to the South Korean president, Kim still is not so trusting of the United States and wants more guarantees that the U.S. will drop what Kim calls its hostile policy against the regime.
Plus, why some Korean families are taking this would-be summit very personally.
I am directly affected by it. Because my family, my grandmother has a family in North where she cannot see them or she doesn't even know if they're alive.
The latest on the summit and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman and this is The World. It's good to have you with us. We hope you're having a relaxing Memorial Day today. We're thinking of fallen American servicemen and women. And with the news from the two Koreas, it's hard not to think specifically of lives lost during the Korean War, a war that technically never ended. The June 12th summit between the U.S. and North Korea, guided with help from South Korea, was looking hopeful. Then last Thursday, a unilateral cancellation from President Trump. And then Saturday morning, President Moon Jae-in of South Korea and Kim Jong-un of North Korea met unannounced. Trump also rejoined the good mood and said things for the summit are going ahead. So as of right now, it appears to be on again. Reporter Jason Strother joins us from Seoul. So on Saturday, South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korea's Kim Jong-un had this secret meeting in the DMZ. What do we know about what was discussed, Jason?
It caught everyone by surprise, and, you know, we didn't know about it until it had already happened. President Moon took about a day to announce what the two leaders discussed. He said that was by request of Kim Jong-un, who didn't want to let the cat out of the bag right away. But pretty much there was nothing new. President Moon said that he and Kim both pledged to rid the entire Korean Peninsula of nuclear weapons, sign a peace treaty that would officially end the Korean War. And Moon says Kim expressed his will, his desire to meet with President Trump.
It kind of feels like the Koreas are going at it alone. How much political support in South Korea does Moon have for his reconciliation efforts?
Well, for instance, Marco, today at the National Assembly, there was a vote on a resolution to uphold some of the agreements made during the inter-Korean summit, and it didn't pass, mostly because party lines. The conservative opposition party, they didn't like the wording in it when it came down to, you know, what North Korea really considers denuclearization. So I think that's going to be a sticking point in all future negotiations with the North.
So if the June 12th summit with the U.S. and North Korea is back on track, I mean, where's the trust right now between all the parties? I mean, is trust increasing between the two Koreas with trust in the United States dropping on both sides of the DMZ?
The relationship between President Moon and Kim Jong-un seems pretty trustworthy right now. Moon said it was like meeting with a friend when him and Kim sat down for talks over the weekend. But according to the South Korean president, Kim still is not so trusting of the United States and wants more guarantees that the U.S. will drop what Kim calls its hostile policy against the regime.
So there's a team of U.S. officials in North Korea now, we hear. What are their goals?
Right. Well, not a whole lot has been said publicly about their mission to the North. Sung Kim, who is the U.S.'s former ambassador to South Korea and who has negotiated with the North in the past, he's leading that team. And his North Korean counterpart is Vice Foreign Minister Chae Sun-hee. She's the woman who last week described Vice President Mike Pence as a political dummy. So I think they've gotten past some of those unflattering words, but they're just right now making the preparations to try to salvage, really, the summit that has been on and off again.
I'm also reading that a team of U.S. officials is in Singapore working on details for the summit. What are you hearing from the street in Seoul? Like, are people saying that Trump maybe just put the summit on pause and didn't actually fully cancel it, as this letter from the White House said last week?
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, Marco, the upcoming Trump-Kim summit, it's not the first thing people talk about, really. It might be a surprise to some Americans that it's important. People know it's happening and they're curious about it, but they have much more pressing matters. For instance, I was hiking over the weekend with some friends, a mixed group of Koreans and expats, And one of my Korean friends was really surprised, I think, how much the other expats were talking about the Trump-Kim summit and this surprise summit between Moon and Kim over the weekend. And she said that she felt that we were much more cynical. We had a very different view than most Koreans did about this whole matter.
It is certainly baffling. I mean, we had President Trump say on Saturday, we're looking at June 12th in Singapore. That hasn't changed, and it's moving along pretty well. What does need to happen now before Trump and Kim meet? Has anything changed regarding either side's views on North Korea's denuclearization?
Well, Marco, I think I can tell you what shouldn't happen. I think both Pyongyang and Washington need to be very careful about what they say publicly. I think any sort of miscommunication, any more, you know, thinly veiled threat, whether it be a nuclear showdown like North Korea said last week, or comparisons to Libya, which has come out from Vice President Pence as well as John Bolton in recent weeks, talk like that could derail the summit. And right now we have these American officials in the North trying to smooth everything over. We have another team of Americans going down to Singapore for talks. Reports say a North Korean delegation is also headed to Singapore. So it looks like it's happening. But again, you know, it only takes a few days for the story to completely change here.
Reporter Jason Strother, based in Seoul, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Talk of peace and war on the Korean Peninsula can be alarming to Americans, but for Koreans, North and South, it's a matter of life and death and divided families. This past weekend, groups of women in North and South Korea staged demonstrations for peace. One group of activists called Women Cross DMZ attempted to cross the frontier itself from the South. Sean Kim was with them. Sean is a young Korean-American woman who recently joined Women Cross DMZ. Her interest is personal.
I was born in South Korea, and I was raised there until I was in seventh grade. But to go deeper than that, actually, my grandmother and my grandfather is from North Korea. They were born in North Korea, and when the Korean War broke, they came down to South Korea. So my grandpa's side, he was able to make it to South Korea, but his dad wasn't able to make it. So his dad was in North Korea. And my grandma, she was able to make it with her dad, but the rest of the family was left in North Korea. So when I was growing up, I was hearing about her story. And then she would always make me this pot sticker whenever we're sick or whenever we were feeling down.
Like a dumpling.
Yes, dumpling. And then it was really big. So until I actually went to someone else's house and had a same dumpling, it was the size difference was huge. The dumpling I had was really big, whereas in someone else's was small. I realized the dumpling that she was giving me was in North Korean style, and I was eating that kind of food. Even after I moved to America, I was always craving for it. My grandmother didn't come to U.S. with us, so she stayed in South Korea. And then I was just, I think, too little to understand what was going on back then, where she was talking about her family back in North. But I didn't understand that. But as I was getting older, I realized that she was really missing her family back in North Korea. But she was keep saying she couldn't go see them. And then she wants to go see them before she dies. She's 93 years old. She's still alive. My grandpa, who's been missing his dad all his life, didn't get to go back to North Korea, and he passed away. So before it's too late, I felt like I want to participate in this because I am directly affected by it. Because my family, my grandmother has a family in North where she cannot see them, or she doesn't even know if they're alive. So I was hoping I could be part of something that's meaningful and see if we can really help South Korea and North Korea to bring peace in Korean Peninsula, and finally give my grandmother a chance to go back to her hometown and just know if her families are alive or not.
Did you do the march across the DMZ yourself? Just walk us through step by step. Did you actually put feet on North Korean soil?
So unfortunately, we didn't get to go to North Korea side because as an American, Trump actually had to put travel van to North Korea. So we had to apply for a special visa. But unfortunately, we got a rejection letter So we couldn't go to North Korea. So what we did was we were only able to walk on the South Korean side of the demilitarized zone. But the meaningful thing was that we were able to walk across the reunification bridge, which is restricted area to civilians. And this was the first time where any civil organization was able to walk that bridge.
So last week when Donald Trump first canceled the summit, how did you feel?
I was very deeply saddened by it. We were very hopeful that something was moving along towards a peace direction. And when Trump finally agreed to meet with Kim, I was really hopeful because I even called my grandma and I talked to my dad. I was like, did you see the news? Maybe we just get a chance, because they were talking about reuniting the family. And when he canceled, I was heartbroken, because that means it was getting delayed for my grandma to really see her family or just know about her family, if they're alive or not. So I called my dad and grandma, and my grandma was disappointed, and I was too.
Then suddenly out of the blue, we had the Korean leaders themselves, Moon and Kim, meeting on Saturday. How did you react when you heard about that?
So it was very surprised, but we were really happy about it, because that was the same day that we were walking and marching through the reunification bridge. So knowing that we were so close to President Moon and the Chairman Kim while they were meeting, we were right there at that moment. We were very close. So it was really exciting, and we were very happy to hear that news. So when they finally met, I mean, that's what we wanted them to do, for them to be able to talk to each other and really figure out what they need to do. And they were doing that already. So it was really a hopeful moment. At the same time, it was really exciting because we were at that place together.
I was looking at the Women Cross the DMZ website, Sean, and they say that catastrophic regional war is a risk that women peacemakers in South Korea and North Korea understand all too well and are not willing to accept. Why do you think women understand the stakes better than men?
Well, a lot of people say it's because, first of all, what we try to do is we try to emphasize and we try to talk heart to heart. Even when we were here today, we were trying to understand that many people are different. We're from different culture. So we try to find a commonality, but at the same time, accept the difference. So by talking through the difference and finding the commonality, we're trying to really find a moment where we can open our hearts, have a discussion, understand the differences, and see if we could truly make peace by talking to each other and really truly understanding that peace will not happen by violence, or war is not an answer to peace. So we're trying to find the way to make peace without really demanding something from someone, but instead trying to see if we can talk about it and then find a better solution, peaceful solution.
Sean, I know you live in California. The Korean Peninsula is in need of your organization's attention right now. Are you going to be on a kind of regular shuttle to Seoul to be doing this work?
For me, I would like to come back here as often as I can and contribute in a way where I could help my grandma to go back to her hometown before she dies, because everyone else passed away. My grandpa passed away without being able to go back to his hometown.
Sean Kim is a peace activist with Women Cross DMZ. Sean, thank you very much for sharing your stories.
Thank you, Marco.
Remembering the 1960s bike share program in Amsterdam, it's Back to the Future, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Like a lot of cities in the U.S. and across the globe, we've got a bike share program here in Boston. It's high profile, has big money corporate sponsorship, and a marketing campaign behind it. In spirit, it's practically the diametric opposite of the original bike share concept. My BBC colleague Janet Ball takes us back to 1960s Amsterdam.
In 1965, the Dutch Provo movement was formed in Amsterdam. It was a playful anarchist group which used non-violent but theatrical protests to bait the police and push its anti-establishment, anti-royal, anti-consumer agenda. One of its members, 30-year-old industrial engineer Luud Schimmelpennink, was determined to find a solution to Amsterdam's rising traffic congestion and pollution levels.
The 60s is still a point that things were changing. It was in the same time that things like this happened.
The Provos published a magazine, and in one of their first editions, Luud announced a revolutionary idea to cut car usage, paint a collection of bikes white, leave them around the city, and let people use them for free. But at first, they didn't have a lot of bikes.
I think it must be about 10 bikes. And the bikes go out in the town and the police take them away because they were against the anarchist Provo movement. They were gone very, very fast. And when you look, what was the white bike? It was only an article in a small magazine and a few bikes painted white.
But the white bike had been born and had caught the public's imagination in the Netherlands and worldwide. The English rock band Tomorrow wrote a song dedicated to them, and soon reporters from around the world interviewed Luud about the idea, much to his neighbours' consternation.
There were people around my home say, okay, what is that to do? Every time there are television stations running on your step, sometimes from Japan, sometimes from United States, sometimes from England. But there was a lot of interest in the things we were doing.
There was only 10 bikes at first. And yet,
yes,
you can Google white bikes now and you see lots of articles, lots of references. Well, you can even see John Lennon and Yoko Ono stood by one. How did that happen?
No, it was very easy. She were in Amsterdam in the hotel, staying in their bed, and somebody brought in the white bike and they make pictures of it. Yeah, they like to support the white bike.
And this was during their famous bed-in protest for peace.
Yes.
They were holding it while they were in their honeymoon in Amsterdam, is that right?
Yes, yes, yes.
But while some people considered the white bikes just a publicity stunt, Luud was determined to make bike sharing a practical reality. 2 years later, he got himself elected to the city council and proposed buying and distributing 10,000 white bikes across Amsterdam. But while the other city councillors listened politely, they weren't impressed with the idea.
There was only one woman who voted also for this system. 43 people voted against my system.
So 43 against, 2 in favour. It wasn't a good ratio for you.
Yeah, that was the case. And for the members of the town council, the future was of the cars and the bike was going out.
So Luud decided that if the councillors wanted cars, he'd give them cars in an electric car sharing scheme called, you guessed it, White Car or Witcar.
De Witcar die hier vertrekt van het nieuwe station bij de Koopmansbeurs.
It cost a lot of time to get permission from Amsterdam, but in 1974 the first station was opened by the Minister of Environment, and that was the start of this system on the street.
De wagen van het Witcar station en steekt de sleutel in het slot, waardoor de deur geopend kan worden.
Newsreel from the 1970s shows a young Luud demonstrating how to use one of the cars, which looks a little bit like a tall white golf cart. He uses a special key to unlock it and selects a destination using a rotary dial. The Witcars are lined up and ready for use in one of the 5 charging stations that were built across the city. But the real leap in technology was that the whole system was computerized.
You come in with your key and you also reserve the place at your destination. We had in Amsterdam a Giro system that was organized with computers, and that was in 1974 a very new product.
Een computer controleert of er op de gekozen bestemming een parkeerplaats vrij is.
The Netherlands banks were not working on computers, but in Amsterdam there was a small finance system, and in their computer room, the Witkar computer was standing there, and every trip was paid by 10 cents a minute.
That's quite remarkable, really, isn't it, that we're talking about 1974. This was state of the art, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
But while the Witkars had proved such a scheme could work, the Amsterdam project soon ran into trouble. It lacked the scale of investment needed, and only 5 charging stations were ever built. This meant all journeys had to end at one of those 5 places, not very convenient for the user. After 12 years in operation, the trustees voted to shut down the system in 1986.
The minimum size of such a system to run real must be at least 25 stations. And we were not coming further than 5 stations. That was our problem.
But Lude was now on the map as the brains behind vehicle sharing systems. And people wanting to create schemes in their own cities started visiting him. Less successful projects which followed included one in Denmark, where users could pay for bike hire by inserting a coin. But with no record of who had taken them, many bikes were never returned. But then, perhaps ironically, the bike share scheme got its biggest boost when it was taken up by the international advertising company JC Decaux. Since 2003, the company has launched nearly 30 city bike share schemes across Europe in return for licenses entitling it to billboard revenues.
It is crazy because they were not really interested in traffic. They were only interested to get places from the town where they can do their advertising.
Have you got a problem with that? You introduced this idea because you thought it would make the world a better place.
Yeah, it was not my call to support advertising. We were against consuming society, but to activate the bike was a good case. They do a start, a real start.
50 years after being branded crazy, Lude is enjoying the fact that millions of people now use car and bike sharing systems worldwide.
Now it is more common to share things, but 50 years ago it was completely a crazy idea. White
bicycle. Lude Schimmelpenning still believes vehicle sharing schemes are the answer to congestion, and that the private car belongs outside of city centres. He's currently working on a 21st century version of Witkar, called Witkar 2.
My colleague Janet Balder reporting from Amsterdam for the BBC's Witness programme. I'm Marco Werman. Irish voters backed legalizing abortion by a wide margin. One blogger says that for many Irish women, the vote was personal.
It was women telling their stories over dinner. It was women chatting to the people in their lives and saying, hey, you know, when I was pregnant, this happened to me, and this is why I think the Eighth Amendment needs to be repealed.
That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH here in Boston. It wasn't even close. Ireland held a referendum on legalizing abortion last Friday, and it was a landslide. Irish voters overwhelmingly chose to repeal the Eighth Amendment. That's a constitutional ban on abortion that was put in place in 1983. Now lawmakers in Ireland will have to start work on rules to make abortion legally available to Irish women. The vote is seen as a historic shift for a country that until recently was heavily influenced by the Catholic Church. Here's The World's Matthew Bell from our religion desk.
Ireland's Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, who supports abortion rights, called the vote a quiet revolution for Ireland.
100 years since women gained the right to vote. Today, we as a people have spoken, and we say that we trust women and respect women to make their own decisions and their own choices.
The vote was 2-1 in favor of repealing the Eighth Amendment, which recognized equal rights to life for both the unborn and the mother. Varadkar said this resounding yes vote was a compassionate choice.
We voted for the 200,000 Irish women who have travelled to Britain since 1983 to end their pregnancies. for the couples who shared their heartbreaking stories of returning home from Liverpool and other English cities with tiny coffins, for the young and not so young women who spoke their truth, and for those stories that still have not been heard.
We had no idea how much of a landslide this was going to be.
Ciara O'Connor Walsh is a podcaster who's been reporting on the abortion debate in Ireland. She says pretty much everyone was predicting a close vote right up until the day of the referendum itself. The polls ahead of time showed that the public was divided evenly, about one-third for repeal, one-third against, and one-third undecided. O'Connor Walsh is a supporter of abortion rights who voted for repeal.
What we had worried and feared is that all of those undecided people were quiet no's, that they were conservative, that they were keeping their opinions to themselves. Maybe they had some strong religious beliefs, or they just felt quite conservative about sharing their views. But what it turned out was that all of those people who were saying they were undecided or they weren't sure, they didn't want to talk about it, they turned out to be silent yes voters rather than silent no.
What moved so many people to vote for repeal? O'Connor Walsh says interviews after the vote show that it was people talking to each other.
It was women telling their stories. And it wasn't just women telling their stories in the media. It was women telling their stories over dinner. It was women chatting to the people in their lives and saying, hey, you know, when I was pregnant, this happened to me. And this is why I think that the Eighth Amendment needs to be repealed, or maybe coming out and telling their family for the first time that they had to travel to seek a termination in the UK. So these kind of conversations were quietly happening all over the country.
Young women in Irish cities were the biggest supporters of repeal, but every age group, except for those over 65, voted in favor of legal abortion. When the Eighth Amendment was put in place in 1983 with another popular vote, Catholic leaders played a major role in getting it passed. But this time around, the Catholic Church stayed on the sidelines. Much of the Irish public has lost faith in the Church as a moral authority since the 1990s. The child sex abuse scandal by Catholic clergy is one reason. Then there were the revelations about abusive homes for unmarried pregnant women that were run by Catholic nuns. On Irish radio this morning, Bishop Kevin Doran said that Catholics who voted yes in Friday's referendum should consider coming to confession. Voting yes, the Irish bishop said, was a sin. But Ciara O'Connor Walsh says this referendum sent a clear message to Catholic leaders in Ireland.
They realize now that people have made a major moral decision, a major decision of conscience, without consulting them and kind of going against the Catholic Church's teachings on this particular issue. And they're doing it out of compassion. And, you know, I think that the church really needs to sit back and ask themselves, you know, how are they going to make themselves relevant again if they can? They're certainly not going to have as much of a place in the running of the state as they have had previously. And I think they need to acknowledge that.
The Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Martin, seemed to do just that. On Sunday, he told massgoers that the Catholic Church will now be regarded with indifference in Ireland. He said the church must renew its commitment to support life at all stages. Supporters of abortion rights in Ireland say the overwhelming results in Friday's referendum will make it easier for lawmakers to move quickly to pass new abortion regulations. There's still a lot to talk about here, such as who exactly will provide abortion-related services and when will that start. The government also says it needs to find a way to permit medical professionals who request it to exempt themselves from providing abortion as a matter of conscience. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
This also happened this weekend. An incredible video, you may have seen it. A toddler is dangling from a fourth-floor balcony in Paris, and a man makes a daring rescue. He scales the building and hoists the child to safety, while the crowd gathers below in the street and cheers him on. It's earned him the nickname Spider-Man. Mamoudou Gassama is his real name, and he's an immigrant from Mali. Paris's deputy mayor, Celia Blauel, praised Gassama earlier today.
This shows actually that we are all the same citizens of the world and that we can be valuable people wherever we come from. In this really troubled Europe, we have to start to find the ways to settle some rules to live together.
There's another layer to the story. Gassama, for the time being anyway, is without papers. But don't you know, just today, Gassama met with French President Emmanuel Macron and is being offered permanent residency, citizenship if he wants it, and a job as a firefighter. Writer and researcher Rimsara Alouane joins us from Toulouse. Rimsara, what was your reaction when you saw this story?
My reaction was, wow, it's 2018 and French politicians and some French discover that undocumented people are humans capable to do good.
Well, that's a fairly cynical reaction.
Cynical or maybe a bit too realistic. Obviously, this man was amazing. His bravery saved a life and he rightly should be praised for it. But what bothered me is the way we are treating undocumented immigrants. They are humans only when they perform an act of bravery. And I will quote you the mayor, the left-wing mayor of the 18th arrondissement where the story happened. Mm. He said, I quote, "Il a fait la preuve de son utilité pour la France. He has proved his usefulness for France."
Wow, that's kind of extraordinary.
Yes, you undocumented person is now a human because you proved you were useful.
What was the response to the video on French social media?
Two kind of response. The vast majority people were amazed by his bravery. People even started a petition for him to get citizenship. So, you know, the first inclination of people in that case would be, okay, he needs to be part of our society, right? And you also have the reactions mostly from the far right saying it's fake news.
Really? They said that?
Like, yes. Yes. You know, these kind of people who said it's a performance so he can get attention. Oh, look, they're recording it. It's not a coincidence.
Why is this story about Mamoudou Gassama resonating so much in France and polarizing the country? Because it does bring up a lot about the relationship between France and immigrants.
Absolutely. You know, we are living at a time in France when you have the United Nations and our French Administrative Supreme Court, the Council of State, requiring public authorities to give water and food to undocumented people in Calais jungle. We have to be reminded that by courts and by the UN.
Now, the jungle is at a well-known refugee camp in Calais on the English Channel.
Absolutely. We live at a time as well where we can detain kids in detention center. We live at a time when far-right group who rent helicopters go and harass and chase undocumented people who try to cross border in the Alps with barely nothing coming from the government to call that out. So I think that this story remind us that we French, who are called the country of human rights, should behave as such.
Do you think Mamoudou Gassama's bravery has changed the tone of the immigration debate in France at all?
I wish I could say yes, but I don't believe so. This story will be forgotten in a couple of days, and we will come back to this routine about how immigrants are coming massively in France. There is an influx of immigrants, and we need to stop that.
Well, I hope you're wrong about his heroism being forgotten because it was pretty epic.
I hope so. Oh, I hope I'm wrong. Trust me, Marco. I hope I'm wrong.
Rimsara Alouane, thank you very much. Good to speak.
Thank you very much for having me.
In those recent clashes on the Gaza border, Israeli forces killed dozens of Palestinian protesters. We heard voices on the show that reminded us how divided and violent the region can be. And given a lot of media coverage, you might think that the only interaction between Israelis and Palestinians in their daily lives is violent, or at least angry. But even in the most divided of places in the Mideast, you find things that bring people together, like car repair. Ari Plakta reports from Modein Elit, an ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlement in the West Bank.
I'm sitting with David near his home in his Citroën Berlingo, a gray French-made van. And there seems to be an issue with his ignition. David asked that I not use his last name, fearing backlash from his community. He could easily go to an Israeli car garage, but instead he calls up Ahmed, a Palestinian mechanic in the village next door, Deir Kadis.
Let's start with the fact that it's cheaper, a lot cheaper, significantly. To get this repair, it would cost me 1,000 shekels there. Here it would cost me at least 3,000.
Everyone loves a good deal, the people of Modi'in Elit included. religious study and family rearing take priority in the ultra-Orthodox community, generally among Israel's poorest. For his part, David is married with three kids and does odd jobs when he's not studying Torah.
The quality of work is just as good. I've had a car for many years, so what reason do I have not to go?
It's difficult to know the scale of this trade, but authorities certainly don't like it, partly for security reasons, and especially now as tensions run high in the West Bank. David shrugs off potential danger.
When you're there, it's less scary than it seems. But if it's your first time and you don't know the place, Arabs, everyone's Arab. Everyone's hanging around. At the end of the day, Israelis live in a reality with Arabs that's not always nice. I don't know if I would recommend other Israelis to go. People who aren't afraid will go and people who are won't. It's not a mall that I tell everyone, come, enjoy. You also have to become familial.
Israeli police recently told David's rabbis in Modi'in Elite that Palestinian garages deal in stolen car parts, so doing business with them encourages car theft inside Israel. Both Israeli and Palestinian police are worried about a flourishing market of stolen parts that's been linked to drugs and weapons smuggling. But David isn't exactly convinced by this narrative.
I personally don't believe in it. I say those who steal will steal anyway. The Arabs, they only acquire parts this way. They buy a lot of carts from Israel that have been in accidents, and the insurance throw them out because they're useless. But over there, it works fine.
Ahmed doesn't do appointments, and it's not looking like he has time for David today. So I sit out for Deir Kadis myself as the sun sets. Luckily, I have David's very specific directions.
No one really knows the name of the place. I just know where it is. It's up the hill and around the corner.
Deir Kadis is on the next hill over from Modi'in Elit. But to get there, I have to drive down from the settlement, cross an Israeli checkpoint, and then drive back up to the Palestinian village.
I'm Ahmed, the electrician. An electrician working in the village here, Deir Kadis.
I find Ahmed Lieb in his small garage, fixing the AC for a customer who lives in the same settlement I just left.
Arabs from Israel come to me, and I have Arabs from here in the village. Arabs come from Ramallah too. A lot of people come here, not just Jews, but most of the people that come here are Jewish because it's close to the border here and half the price.
The garage Ahmed opened up 7 years ago is full of used parts. Different gauges, meters, and various engine components. The sort of things you'd think might look suspicious to police. Ahmed admits there's questionable activity happening around him. But he insists his business is illegal and is frustrated by police suspicion.
I think it's not right. Nearly all the parts here are from cars after accidents. And all are legal. Almost. Who here sells illegal parts? Who could keep a stolen car here? Almost every day the police come here and hang around.
Closing up shop, Ahmed talks about a recent visit by one of his Jewish friends, now living in the U.S. He wants to stress, it seems, that his relationship to customers on the hill next door aren't just business. What exists here, in some ways, is like any other neighborhood.
People have known each other here for years. I'm age 40-something. I know people maybe for more than 20 years. And they come all the way to my house. It's quiet here. People get along with one another.
But one violent incident here, David and Ahmed both say, could make their relationship impossible. For now, it appears that enough locals consider this kind of car talk well worth protecting. For The World, Ari Plakta, The West Bank.
Taiwan has got a demographic problem. Fewer and fewer children are being born, which means the population in Taiwan is aging out fast. One of the reasons for the dropping birth rate, a lot of couples feel like they have no time for kids because of their demanding, stressful jobs. My BBC colleague Cindy Su went to a business district in the capital Taipei recently to ask workers about this as they left the office buildings where they're logging those long hours.
Jin Wang stops to talk. She's 30 and has a boyfriend. But as to marriage and children, that's a big question.
I'm not sure because I have a very busy job. Yeah, so mostly I have worked until maybe 8 or 9 o'clock. So after work, I just want to go home and take a rest and don't want to.
You don't even want to see him?
Too tired.
So is he anxious to get married as well?
No.
Okay. No. So both, he also works really hard?
Yes.
Then I meet Sam, a 43-year-old man who has given up on dating.
I don't want to get married. I've had girlfriends, but our personalities and family backgrounds were too different. Actually, it's very nice being single.
So you're not worried about Taiwan's low birth rate and, you know, aging population?
I'm worried, but what can I do?
Taiwan's government has taken action. It's introducing subsidies for childcare to encourage more people to have children. Some local governments even give cash to couples who have babies. And there's paid extended maternity leave. But Lydia Huang, another office worker hurrying home, is quick to point out a stumbling block.
Taiwan's middle-income people get married late. By the time they start thinking about having children, they worry whether they have the stamina and the money. In Taiwan, you might have to give up your career because Taiwanese companies grade you on your performance each year to determine your salary rise. In my company, whoever goes on maternity leave always gets the lowest grade.
Less than 1 month old, this baby boy is visiting a restaurant for the first time with his proud parents.
I'm really happy to be a dad. It's a very mysterious feeling.
That's new father, Yoko Liu. But he won't be spending much time with his son, as he'll be returning to his job in mainland China, where salaries are higher. And mother Angela Shen won't be asking for extended paid maternity leave, as she says too many companies frown on it. In fact, the couple is fortunate because their parents live nearby and will take care of the baby during the daytime. Many of their friends see their children only once or twice a month because they stay with grandparents who live in another part of Taiwan. Taiwan's child-friendly measures, which may look good on paper, haven't yet turned it into a child-friendly society.
The BBC's Cindy Su reporting from Taiwan's capital, Taipei. I've lived in the Boston area long enough now that I don't even blink at the local idiosyncrasies anymore. I just accept them, like the older convenience stores that are called spas. I don't know why they call them that. You don't go there for a massage. My colleague here at WGBH, reporter Edgar B. Herwick III, decided to get to the bottom of this mystery after he got a call from someone who was wondering about these spas. And Edgar started asking questions just down the street from our studios.
Here we've got some toiletries,
candy, snacks,
we've got newspapers, a little bit of a miniature bread aisle, soda and juices. You know, all in all, this is your pretty typical corner store. And while it has all the hallmarks, this particular store is not called a shop or a market, a grocery or a mart. This is the Palace Spa. Yugur Patel is the owner here. He bought the place in 2001.
Where'd you get the name?
Oh, it was from the previous owner.
Did you ever wonder why it's called the Palace Spa?
I don't know. I think it's the old New England traditional. That's what everybody said.
Patel is right. This kind of a spa is unique to New England. As for it being an older tradition, that tracks with what Mary Logue told me at Victoria Spa in Watertown, which is where she has lived all 80 years of her life.
All of them were spas. We came in for bread and milk and staples.
So sort of like a little
convenience store, like a neighborhood shop.
And they were all called spas?
Yeah.
And you never thought that that was weird?
No.
Because that's just how it was?
Yeah.
But to anyone not from around here, it is a bit curious.
Hi, my name is Vasant Marur. I live in Boston in the neighborhood of Fenway. I was wondering if you know why convenience stores or corner stores in Boston are called spas.
Now, the word spa comes to English from Belgium and the town of Spa, so named for its bubbling natural mineral spring believed to have healing powers. Resorts built around mineral springs became known as spas. And from there, you can see why today we use it for swanky resorts, health and beauty treatments, and backyard whirlpools. but convenience stores?
There fortunately exists the Dictionary of American Regional English.
That's Julie Roberts, director of the linguistics program at the University of Vermont. It is in this dictionary that she found the key to how spa got its distinct New England spin. And it's thanks to a different kind of bubbling water.
It probably originally applied to a soda fountain.
The earliest known usage of the word spa for a soda fountain comes from an 1895 article in a Pennsylvania newspaper.
But it was in an article about Boston. It said in
Boston, Thompson's Spa, the greatest soda resort at the hub, easily clears for its owners $50,000 a year.
For decades, soda fountains were staples at drugstores and five and dimes, themselves versions of the modern convenience store. And so you can see how it all happened. And it is unique to this area. Peculiar word usage like this, along with distinct pronunciations, like, say, dropping the R in a word like Harvard, are crucial hallmarks of this area's unique dialect, known in linguistic circles as Eastern New England English.
Isolation really is what encourages dialect retention.
But, of course, we've never been less isolated than we are today. And as regional dialects across the country shift and disappear, scholars are working furiously to catalog and track them as they do. Unless you think this is all quite trivial.
When a dialect shifts, that usually means a whole way of life and an identity of a people is shifting. It's one marker of what we're essentially changing and what we're losing.
Some studies have shown that Eastern New England English is slowly losing things like its famed dropped R's. But at least for now, you can still grab a moxie and a scratch ticket at the local spa. For The World, Edgar B. Herwig III, Boston.
I really did not know that, and I've lived here for more than two decades. Anyway, that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the rest of your holiday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.